Time to take a look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller, and happy to have you along today as we look at what's going on in that world of wildlife. Certainly, if you have questions or comments, we always welcome them. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Give a call. We'll be glad to get you on the line. Scott, welcome back. Nice to have you with us again.
Good to be here, Larry, albeit a bit of a chilly walk over to the studio.
Terrible time in Florida. I mean, there were 20 people killed, and we're not going to minimize that at all. That's a terrible tragedy. And in the world of wildlife, it was also kind of a tragedy, I think, as well, for the 17 whooping cranes, which had flown from here to Florida. We got them all there, and then they died in the terrible storms.
Yes, the program of leading those young cranes south from Nisida Refuge, where they're raised up to flight stage and then following these ultralight aircraft all the way across the central part of the country down to the refuge in Florida, has really captured the public's imagination and mind's eye and so forth over the last few years. But, it was just one of those things. It is a tragedy, very unfortunate, and it's a setback for the program. But on the positive side, the flock down there that had swelled to 81 birds with that infusion of new birds this year has fallen back, obviously. I think it's to 63 or thereabouts, but nevertheless, the nucleus of a flock is still there. There's no way to know at this point, or at least I haven't heard anything about whether any of the other birds that were wintering in that part of Florida, essentially on their own, were lost. We may not know that for quite some time. And, you know, it will take a bit of recovery, but it's just all the people who invest the kind of time and effort in getting those birds down there. And this year, I think the first time, they all made it.
They all made
safely.
It.
They're all there. They're doing great. Everybody's back slapping. This is terrific. And then, whomp, a fluke storm, and they're gone. So,
well, let's go to the phones. And maybe we've got some more upbeat things to talk about here with Bill in East Troy. Hi, Bill. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Yes. Yes. On a lighter note, when I was a teenager, now this is 35, 40 years ago,
okay,
in central Illinois, and my father would take me pheasant hunting. So it was all a bunch of us. It was maybe four or five men and three of us kids, and we all had guns and everything. And we're walking through this big cornfield, and this big flock of pheasant came up. Big flock of pheasant. So it's through the intervening years, it's probably gotten bigger. But anyhow, let's say 30 pheasant flew up, and everybody was aiming at the pheasant, and the whole flock flew away with nobody firing a shot, because the leader pheasant, the pheasant right in the, was a big cock pheasant. It was snow white. It was an albino pheasant.
Huh.
And so you'd think that albinism would be deleterious, but in this case, it saved them all.
The shock value saved the whole flock.
And you don't hear a lot about albino pheasants, Scott.
No, not a lot. It certainly happens. And it's more common to see the opposite, a melanistic pheasant, a jet black pheasant.
Yes.
With kind of an iridescent glow to it. And those are routinely stocked on some of the shooting preserves and game farms in Wisconsin. But the albinos are unusual. It's interesting that would come up as the first call, because I don't know if you've seen them or not, but there's been a series of pictures circulating on the Internet. In fact, I think I was going to talk a little later about pictures on the Internet, what you can believe and what you better take with a grain of salt. There's two moose, snow white.
Oh.
Two albino moose together on the side of the road. But as usually happens with these photographs, there's either no caption at all, no information, or a series of, you see it one day and, oh, yes, they're from Newfoundland. The next day they're from British Columbia. The next day they're from northern Wisconsin. So it's very difficult to pin down what happened, but in this case, it looked certainly like a legitimate photograph, and those two old moose were just snow white.
Snow white.
Certainly stood out in the background. So it happens with a lot of species, but in that case, the pheasants got away.
They all got away.
They all got away.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call. Well, let's talk a little bit about the Internet and those pictures, and we've all seen many, many pictures that we believe sometimes and sometimes we skeptical of.
In a way, it's terrific because I capture lots of really neat images that you would just never get a photograph of otherwise. The series last year that showed the bear shinning along a wire to get at a suspended bird feeder was a great series. And I use those. And then there was another series that showed a cougar, allegedly from a trail cam here in Wisconsin, that was sneaking up on a deer, but the deer was a mule deer and the tree was a ponderosa pine, and it clearly came from some western state. Or the famous set, probably 3 or 4 years ago that circulated, where allegedly a huge python had swallowed someone at an oil camp in Venezuela. And there were a series of pictures showing the snake with a huge lump in its gut, and then it was sliced open. And here's this poor guy curled up in the bed of the pickup truck from the snake's belly, which all proved to be a hoax eventually. The point being, while you can capture some great images, and I really appreciate the people who see something really cool kind of circulating it, but I guess I'd urge anybody who has something they feel is good enough to get out to the masses, for crying out loud, take credit for it and let people know where and when it was taken and the circumstances. Otherwise, that enters or causes an element of doubt, and you wonder whether the whole thing is staged.
No.
And, I mean, with Photoshop, you can practically create anything you want. So it's a great opportunity, but on the other hand, it causes a lot of aggravation when the things prove to be hoaxes.
Marlis in Cambridge, it's your turn now. Hi, Marlis.
Hello. I just had a sort of a comment and also wondering about what I saw. We have a bird feeder in our backyard, and we have sparrows and blue jays and cardinals and a number of birds that you would expect to see this time of year. In the coldest past few days, there were no birds all day long. And I thought for sure they would show up because they must be hungry. Now they are back. But what happened to them in the very coldest weather that they didn't come?
Well, if it's extremely cold, the birds may be better off from an energetic standpoint and just fluffing up, getting into cover up against a tree trunk or in some evergreens or something, or a tree cavity for little things like chickadees and whatnot, and just toughing it out. My feeders have kind of gone through the same thing, although there's been pretty good, surprisingly good activity right through the cold weather, especially among the jays and the cardinals and the woodpeckers. The cold hasn't slowed them down. Some of the smaller stuff, the finches and whatnot and the chickadees, seem to have disappeared, and I think that they're just kind of toughing it out. The pheasants that come to the feeder were interesting in the bitter cold on Sunday. Although they'd usually be rummaging around for seeds spilled from the feeders, they showed no interest in the seed, and rather each pheasant crawled into the center of a dogwood bush, right into that tangle of stems, and just kind of hunkered down in that tangle and sat there and didn't show a great deal of interest in the food. So I think that the cold weather, for one thing, has brought birds back to the feeding stations in a general sense. So folks who were concerned during that warmer weather in December and January, oh, where are all the birds? Well, they didn't need the feeders, but now they need the feeders. So make sure they're clean, make sure they're full, and as soon as the weather's right, the birds will be there trying to get something to eat.
I had similar experiences with our bird feeders as well. The small birds just seem to disappear. Thanks, Marlis.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call. You can join in as well with your own question or comment as we talk the world of wildlife with Scott Craven. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Barbara in Stevenson, Michigan, you're next. Hi, Barbara. Thank you very much for calling.
Hi. Really?
Oops. Sorry.
Hello?
Yeah, We're here.
Okay. I have a question. First, I'd like to know if cardinals mate forever.
For life, okay.
Yeah.
No. They certainly do pair up, but I think there are times of the year when they're not, they're pretty much on their own. Although, I know we should really get our bird watchers to clarify that for us, because it's usually the case, at least around my feeders, that if cardinals are coming in, they tend to be coming in as a pair. And it's a bit early in the spring for that if they don't, in fact, stay together. So we should get some clarification from our 6 million birders who are listening. So.
Well, the reason I asked is I observed a pair of cardinals. Now, it's the red cardinal, the male,
right,
which obviously was dead. But the female, the caramel-colored one, mm-hmm. was actually carrying it and trying to fly and carry it away. And I thought perhaps if they were life breeders that she might be trying to revive him, bring him back to the nest or whatever. But this just happened in the last week, and she struggled so to carry him off.
Well, yeah, and I guess you need to help us out here. How was she trying to carry this bird? I mean, that would be an incredible struggle, and they certainly don't have grasping feet to do that. She was trying to carry it in her bill?
No, with her feet. She had a hold of him with her feet and was actually off the ground, and not very high, of course, but I didn't have time to watch as far as she could go. Hmm. But I just thought it was very strange, and I had never seen anything like that.
Well, I certainly concur with your assessment. It is
yes.
It is very strange. I've not seen anything like it, but we've certainly had examples, and I have seen examples in other birds and other wildlife where a member of a mated pair is either in captivity or injured, and either family members or the member of the pair either stay with it or in some cases try and help it up or in some other ways try and interact with a debilitated or restrained member of the pair. And I can remember with Canada geese, which do mate for life, having injured birds that were rehabilitating in a pen and having perfectly normal free-flying birds all of a sudden show up outside the pen just standing there. And you could not shoo them away. They would simply stay. And eventually, as we'd release birds that were rehabilitated, you'd come to the right bird that could fly again, and all of a sudden they'd fly away together. So it does happen, but the notion of a cardinal trying to carry another cardinal of the same mass seems pretty hard to understand or figure out. But we certainly can't question what you saw with your own eyes.
That's
so
right.
we'll ask our listeners to, when they're calling in to tell us about the mating patterns, maybe they can comment on this notion of trying to carry their dead mate.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah,
okay.
Thanks, Barb. Paul in Winona, Minnesota, you are next. Hi, Paul.
Yes, thank you. I'm on a cell phone. I'll make it brief. Mine is in relation to redheaded woodpeckers, and I've heard various notions about the decline in their population. One is the decline of the natural oak savannas.
Mm-hmm.
Some people say there's introduction of more invasive, competitive bird species, and I've also heard the decline of the American elm tree. So if you would shed some light on that, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Well, red-headed woodpeckers are beautiful, probably our prettiest woodpecker,
yeah,
as far as I'm concerned, with the stark black and white and that bright red head. But they are a bird, unlike where we think of most our woodpeckers being forest land species, obviously heavily dependent on trees and extensive trees. You're right. The red-headeds are more birds of open oak savannas, scattered trees, mixed agricultural landscapes. And they have been experiencing some population declines. And I think all of the causes that you cited, I've not seen any definitive work that says, well, this is the absolute reason. But competition with other birds that are going after nesting cavities, things like starlings, is an issue. The decline in that habitat type in terms of development for rural subdivisions and homes, agricultural land uses and so forth have taken the toll. And since red-headed woodpeckers are often foraging and seen along roadsides or crossing the roads, there's occasionally even highway mortality as they flap low across the road. So I think there are probably a number of things going on, but you're correct in the population decline. And I don't know if anybody's come up with any brilliant solutions to that problem.
Yeah. Thanks, Paul, for calling. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for listening in. And again, if you have a question, give us a call at 800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Dave in Fort Atkinson, you are next. Hi, Dave.
Hello, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I live right on the Rock River in Fort Atkinson, and occasionally in the winter I'll see a carp that has been dragged up on the ice, and over a few days it will be slowly devoured.
Mm-hmm.
You can see a trail coming, you know, from the water or from the shore.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming these are river otters, but I've never seen one. And do river otters live in burrows on the shore?
Sure, they can, and there are other animals that might do the same thing. I mean, a big old carp would be a bit of a struggle for a mink, but that's another possibility. With snow cover, otter tracks or trails are about as distinctive as any animal track there could possibly be in the winter, since they tend to propel themselves on their belly with the result of creating a trench in the snow 8 or 10 inches wide, alternating with a few loping strides and then another trench, especially where there's a little relief in the landscape. So if you go down to check that out or inspect it, that kind of sign, as far as the otters are concerned, should be very easy to find on the bank or moving out to the carp or whatever else. If you find something else, especially in the form of tracks, then armed with a field guide or a little bit of observation, you should be able to figure that out too. But it's certainly possible that they're otters, and they're a large enough, strong enough animal to lug a carp out of the water.
All right.
There are a couple of other things you might just mention. I mean, that's the kind of perfect example, if it would be, you know, safe to do it from a standpoint of theft or vandalism. If you've got a friend with, or if you want to get in, and they've become very inexpensive, these motion-sensitive cameras, trail cameras as they're called, I mean, that's a perfect kind of thing to set up a trail camera on and then just wait and see what you get. And you'll certainly get some images of whatever's working on the carp and answer the question once and for all.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
And finally, on the track end of things, let's
talk about that book.
Well, a little later we want to talk about this book. The book that I'm holding in my hand, not that you can see it, is called Animal Skulls, A Guide to North American Species. And the author's name is Elbrock. And we've talked before about a couple of other books, one called Mammal Tracks and Sign, which is the one that would be relevant to the otter carp situation here, and Bird Tracks and Signs. And I've portrayed them before as being the best books that I've seen on interpreting things that you see in the wild, tracks and droppings and scat and dens and hairs and things like that. But this new one just came out recently, and I got it earlier this week, and it is just terrific for my class in vertebrate ecology. And if you're fascinated by skulls, or you find skulls, you have a skull collection, you've seen a skull, you find owl pellets with little skulls in them, this is just a fantastic reference for sorting out, and it's not easy to do, but sorting out what kind of skulls you have. So I just wanted to plug that. Animal Skulls by Mark Elbrock, and like the other two on Signs and Tracks, you can find them online, probably at a local bookstore, but also online at Amazon or whatever. And for a book of this size and the quality of the illustrations, you can get it packaged with the field guides, and I think this one online cost me like $31, something like that. So
goodbye.
For the size of the book, it's a good buy.
All right. Thanks again, Dave, for calling. Let's go to Dave in Adams County next. Dave, hi to you.
Hey, Scott and Larry. Listen to you guys for a long time. Been an avid deer hunter for many years, and I ride around out in the country every day.
Mm-hmm.
I do see a lot of cool things, but today I seen my first wolves in natural setting, and there's no mistake about these animals. I know there's some controversy about them, but until someone sees these in the wild, they have no idea how magnificent and beautiful they really are. That's my comment. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Well, they are a spectacular animal, but as you point out, Dave, they play to a mixed review, unfortunately, and timely to bring that up, I guess, because beyond the crane deaths that we talked about earlier, the big news this week has been the federal government finally moving off first base, I guess, and preparing to delist the Western Great Lakes population of gray wolves, which includes Wisconsin. So it's something the DNR has been waiting for a long time. It's supposed to be published by the federal government tomorrow, and the delisting, I think, will take effect on the 10th of March. And at that point, federal protection for these wolves will come to an end. And that essentially turns over management to the DNR, or basically the state and other states that have the wolves in this area. And that opens the door for something some folks in the North Woods have been calling for, which is more proactive control or management of wolf numbers as they continue to grow in terms of trying to prevent things like livestock depredations or the deaths of hunting dogs and things like that. So this will greatly facilitate the DNR revisiting their management plans and goals and give them essentially the power to control our own fate with wolves here in Wisconsin.
Hmm. Thanks again, Dave. Nancy in Stoughton, your turn now. Hi, Nancy.
I got good news about cardinals.
Mm-hmm.
I live in Stoughton in a fairly remote place, and I've always had cardinals around my house all the time, but I couldn't tell if they were nesting pairs or not. Well, yesterday, a pair came into my feeder. The male was sitting on the feeder eating, and the female was sitting in the bush behind. And I think she'd been in the feeder first because the chick turned one and the other and then going in. But when the male left, he was done and they were both done and took off. But they were definitely a pair, a healthy pair in Stoughton.
So there was a pair that came in together. And we had some background noise there, Nancy, so we didn't hear everything. But a pair came in together, a male and a female. They fed together and they left together. And so Nancy thinks they're a pair.
Well, it sounds like pretty good evidence to me, so we'll go with that. And again, this is a common observation, as I mentioned earlier, for them to come in as pairs and occasionally even the male to pass a seed to the female or whatever. So we just need to establish from somebody who's got access to a bird reference that I don't have here whether that pair bond persists throughout the year.
Hmm, interesting. Thanks, Nancy, for calling. Stella in Sturgeon Bay, it's your turn now. Hi, Stella.
Hi. Scott, the last time that you were on the radio, we had a drama out in our driveway the night before and went out and saw it, but I wasn't in time to get on. What happened was there were signs in the snow, there were signs of a really massive struggle.
Mm-hmm.
When my husband checked at night, and he went across and he found the carcass, the headless carcass of a large rabbit.
Mm-hmm.
And the struggle had wingtip marks.
Mm-hmm.
And it was dragged across the driveway, and there were wingtip marks. So it clearly, and then later we saw an owl.
Mm-hmm.
So it was pretty clear that the owl had caught the rabbit,
mm-hmm.
and we had scared it away. And its headless carcass was next to a trailer in our backyard.
Mm-hmm.
The next morning we went out to look at it more carefully, and there was a trail of drag marks and wingtip marks across our neighbor's backyard. And under a cedar tree in her backyard, we found the headless and front legless carcass of the rabbit.
Mm-hmm.
And my question was, it just seemed really, there weren't any footprints, so there wasn't, a dog or something didn't come and chew part of the carcass off.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seems really peculiar that an owl would eat the head, take the head and the front legs, which would be the least nutritious, least useful part of the animal.
Well, actually, it's pretty common in terms of the way great horned owls kill and utilize prey to take the heads.
Really?
And it's a problem, for example, when owls are depredating poultry, pheasants or chickens or whatnot, and get them stirred up and they fly up into the mesh that might be covering the pen. And the owls will grab them there, and again, the heads may be removed. So there may be a number of prey with the heads removed. So what you describe, it occurred at night. It was a rabbit, which is a common prey item of horned owls. Horned owls are very active now. They're starting to nest, and that's a typical means of killing. And if you saw the trail where the rabbit was probably just too heavy for the owl to make off with intact, it took the head first and then probably in a combination of flapping and dragging got it off to what it felt was a secure spot and continued to feed on it. And had it not been discovered, might have continued to feed on it beyond that until it could have actually carried away whatever it could manage.
Well, it probably did continue because we left it.
Well,
yeah.
then, but I'm almost positive that what you discovered was the scene of a rabbit killed by a great horned owl, and that's a fairly typical way for them to feed on them.
Hmm,
well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Stella.
Cleared up a puzzle.
All right, thanks, Stella. Jay in Appleton, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Jay.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, I was driving my car in my neighborhood a couple of weeks ago, and there was a really big red-tailed hawk standing over a dead squirrel. And I parked my car about 20 feet away from it and watched it, and I scared it off. And I watched it in the tree for a while, and then I had to get going. I drove back a couple hours later, and that squirrel was still sitting on the sidewalk, and I was just wondering, if I scared that hawk off, will that just leave that squirrel sitting there and not come back to finish the job? Or
well, It sounds like the job was finished from the standpoint of the squirrel.
Yeah.
But as far as the hawk was concerned, you know, a squirrel's a tough animal. Their hide is tough. They cling tenaciously to life. And red-tailed killing a squirrel is a major undertaking. So usually once they've got prey like that, they're pretty tenacious in terms of trying to hang on to it and will tolerate someone standing there watching them. So if the bird was frightened off to the point that it left that hard-won prize, it must have been frightened probably by more than you just, you know, sitting there in your vehicle.
Yeah.
I don't know what might have scared it off, but something obviously caused the bird to decide that picking up that squirrel and finishing it off was not worth whatever risk it perceived.
Yeah, because I sat there and watched it for about 45 seconds before it took off. I was just wondering if I scared it off, it'll just leave that and not go back to it.
It apparently that was the case, although it may have gone back later. We have no way of knowing. But
yeah.
As I say, the bird had to work hard for that squirrel, and something must have really frightened it to drive it out of the area.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Jay. Gene in Green Bay, your turn now. Good morning.
Yes, I just have a couple questions. Folks have been calling in about no birds at their feeders, and we have had birds constantly, finches, chickadees, juncos, mourning doves. And my question is, especially the finch feeders we have close to our house, we have three or four of them, and they're always, right now we have about 15 out there feeding. But then that's the one question. And then the other one, how about, and we do this, an electrical unit in your bird bath, and they just seem to be there all the time. Getting water. Is mm-hmm. that why we're having birds?
Well, water with a little electrical element in it, like a cup heater and so forth, which are sold at many bird feeding and outdoor supply stores, is water's a common or an attractive feature.
Right.
And if you don't happen to be near a spring or stream or other water source that hasn't frozen up,
right.
The water can be very attractive to the birds.
Uh-huh.
Ordinarily, there's enough melting on the south side of a house and whatnot that birds can find some dripping or water, but it's been so darn cold
right.
that water may be in shorter supply than food.
Right.
And that's probably a contributing factor, but you also may have just the right combination of shelter
mm-hmm.
Such that your feeders are out of the wind
right.
and the wind chill's been brutal.
Right.
Or you've got the evergreens that they're roosting in and they can
right.
get to the feeders easily,
uh-huh.
or there aren't other people close by feeding. So
there
could be a variety of reasons why you've got them, but you know, don't look a gift horse in the mouth. If you've got all the birds you want, you're in good shape.
Well, what about the mourning dove? I always heard they migrate, but we've had them stick around.
Well, some certainly do migrate, but some also overwinter here, so it's a mixed bag. I have mourning doves at my feeders regularly
uh-huh.
every day. So
if you feed them, they'll come, I guess.
Yes. So there are mourning doves around no matter how cold it gets, but some of them also do clear out and head south.
Okay. All right.
Thank
you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Gene. And let's turn to Tim in Eau Claire next. Hi, Tim.
How do you do? So I got a question for you.
Okay.
What's the difference in size between a coyote track and a wolf track? I had an animal run through my driveway yesterday. It's either the biggest coyote known to man or a medium-sized wolf. And I'm just curious what the size difference was in tracks.
Well, the tracks will be very similar in overall appearance and shape and number of toe pads and all that kind of stuff. But a wolf track is probably going to be a good 4 inches.
It's about the size of a deck of cards, pretty much.
Well,
maybe a little bigger.
I don't have a deck of cards here, but in light snow and a moving animal and a good-sized coyote, I suppose that's possible. But the wolf track should be, I'm trying to think of a deck of cards here, maybe 3 inches across.
Yeah.
That's kind of one of those tweeners that could go either way. But I think, especially with that setting, running across your driveway, this is a suburban area kind of thing?
That's about 5 miles south of Eau Claire, out in the sticks a bit, with a lot of cardinals around, by the way.
Well, good. You know, it could be either one, but I think if you, the books that we were just talking about in terms of animal tracks and sign, or even the Peterson Field Guide to Mammal Tracks, any of those will have, or if you've got access to a computer, just Google wolf track, and it'll give you a perfect image, and you can probably, life size, and you can print that and compare it to the track you saw.
Well, mm-hmm. I've seen coyotes before, and this thing was awful big for a coyote, I thought, but yeah. that could be wrong. But all right, thanks a lot.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Scott, I wanted to talk about the deer harvest a little bit with you. Did we reach our goals?
Well, it was. They're still sorting some of that out, but overall, there were a couple of bits of good news. For one thing, the harvest in that special December hunt, the four-day December antlerless hunt that was so controversial, it was kind of viewed as a pilot. There were about 19,000 antlerless deer taken that during that hunt, and that seemed to generate a fair bit of favorable response. So that was good news, and I think the speculation that I've seen is that it was probably enough of a harvest to warrant continuing that for another year and not going back to the October hunting for antlerless deer that was also controversial but for different reasons. So that was good. The December harvest was good. All told, the overall harvest of deer was around 490,000, give or take change. It's a lot of dead deer, yeah. Almost 500,000. Not approximating the record kill of 2000, which was 618,000, but I think the 490,000 put us in pretty close to the top five, I think, in terms of deer harvest. So it was a good year. And they're now getting ready to enter the phase of deer management unit-by-unit reviews with the public and go over the harvest for individual units and see if the ratio of antlerless deer to bucks was satisfactory, then total harvest was satisfactory, so that they can work up to next year's
goals,
regulations. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line was it was a good deer harvest. It was a good season. I haven't seen numbers yet on the number of deer taken in the chronic wasting disease management areas, and they've been flying those with helicopters for the past few weeks to take a look at what's left out there in the landscape. So we'll have that information maybe at the next program, the 1st of March. But overall, it was a good season. And the other aspect, and it was a record, is that out of those 490,000 deer, almost 12,000 were donated by hunters to the food pantry donation program. And that totaled, I'm trying to think of the estimate here. Oh, I don't know. I guess it doesn't say in the news release I've got, but many, many, well, actually, yes, it does. Here we are, 533 pounds of ground venison distributed to folks who need the protein.
Thousand.
So 500, yeah, 1,000.
530,000.
Half a million pounds. So that's a very worthwhile thing. I think it makes the hunters feel good. It's a good thing for harvested deer that other people can't use in another way. So yep. Good deal.
Good deal. Bridget in Bailey's Harbor, your turn next. Hi, Bridget.
Hi, how you doing?
Great. Thanks for calling.
I'm curious. I used to live on Bister Lake in Florida, and I read an article about the whooping cranes, and I'm wondering if they would have survived had they not been kept in an enclosure. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Yeah.
Well, that's what a lot of people were wondering is that, you know, gee, here these storms hit, you know, I think back to a movie where the tornado is bearing down on the barn and somebody bravely rushes out and releases the horses and so forth to fend for themselves. Apparently, that was not possible, that no one really thought this was a possible problem, that the pens, such as they were inaccessible or made inaccessible by the storms. And I'm led to believe that the storms came up very, very suddenly and unpredictably. So that's a possibility, but it's a possibility if it could have been done, but it couldn't be done. And I think the birds have been sent in for necropsy, or essentially trying to determine what actually killed them, whether it was a storm surge and they drowned, or whether they were essentially victims of a lightning strike, or what did them in. And I don't think we have the definitive answer on that. If it was something like lightning, then the pen was somewhat irrelevant. So,
and if they're not penned in, the problem is predation by other animals.
Right. They've had problems in the past with problems with bobcats and other predators taking them out. So the pen, while in this case proved to be perhaps detrimental, perhaps not, the alternatives weren't very good either.
Hmm. Karen in Greenbush, your turn now. Hi, Karen.
Good morning.
Morning.
This morning I was taking a little walk. I live up near the northern Kettle Moraine, and I saw out of the corner of my eye a bird flying. I thought it was a mourning dove. And when it landed, I realized it was a small owl.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering, it's just a little bigger than a mourning dove, and wondered if you could tell me what kind it was. And is it odd that it's active, about 9:30 in the morning? I thought they were more active at night.
They are more active at night, but they certainly, I mean, they don't vanish during the day, so there's no telling how or why it might have been disturbed or otherwise inclined to move from point to point. Sometimes when they're discovered during the day by crows or other birds that tend to mob or harass owls, the owl simply eventually has enough of it and moves on to another spot. So there's no way to predict that. The two small owls that, very small owls that we have, the most common is a screech owl. And next to that, and even a little smaller, would be a saw-whet owl. And, you know, they're both small, so I think the only thing I can tell you to do, if you've still got kind of an image of it in your mind's eye, is to thumb through a field guide or go on the internet and check out owls and look at the screech owl, which could be in a couple color phases, could have been rusty brown, could have been pale gray, or the saw-whet owl, and see if you can figure out what you saw.
Okay, it flew into a... There's kind of a dying tree there, and it actually flew into a little cavity at the top of that tree.
Uh-huh.
So I'm wondering, do you think there's a good chance that it may be living in there?
Yes, a very good chance, and that's certainly what a resident screech owl would do, but not out of the question for the other one either. So if you know where that cavity is, that's something you could revisit on your walks. And if you're bold enough to be out in this kind of weather, when the weather moderates, you could actually sit there a bit and see if you could make an observation.
Okay, thank you.
Yep, thanks for calling. And let's go to Donna in Green Bay. Hi, Donna.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm planning garden in this cold weather, and I've had a critter problem last summer, and I'm wondering if you can give me some help. I've got some kind of animal that is getting into my garden, which is rabbit-proofed. It's fenced and rabbit-proofed, and we're in the city of Green Bay, that goes in and takes the cobs of corn that are just ripening off of the stalk.
Mm-hmm.
And takes the, you know, shucks the corn and eats it and leaves the empty cobs right at the gate of my fence.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering what kind of animal this could be and if there's anything at all that I can add to this fence of mine that might keep this thing out.
Well, the most likely culprit, if the cobs are they stripped pretty clean?
Yeah.
I mean, what you find left is kind of messy. The cob is all the corn is chewed off and the husk is all shredded and it's a mess.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, it certainly sounds like a raccoon, and they're quite capable. Certainly, there are many coons in the urban environment living in storm sewers and people's attics and under decks and whatnot, and they're quite capable of climbing over whatever your rabbit-proofing is, and they're notorious for hitting sweet corn literally the day before you were going to pick it
exactly.
for dinner.
Yeah.
They somehow, you know, they're after the same sugar content and taste that we are, and they hit it literally a few days before our harvest. So the likely culprit is the raccoon, and that's going to be a little tough. If one possibility, again, depending on the setting of your yard and what kind of control over kids and neighbors and so forth you have, a single-strand electrified fence wire on the top of your rabbit-proof fence or set just off the ground outside the rabbit-proof fence could discourage the raccoons, but you'd have to deal with your gate as well. It's also possible that just maybe a week or two before the corn is maturing, that a well-positioned, sturdy live trap baited with dog food, cat food, or something the raccoons might be interested in might allow you to capture the animal and remove it from the scene before the corn damage.
Okay.
And then there are certainly other circumstances, too. I mean, a lot of accidents can befall an urban raccoon between last year's corn crop and this year's.
Uh-huh.
So some year, what I'm getting at is that some years I have a lot of trouble in my sweet corn with coons, some years none at all. So it doesn't necessarily follow that because you had problems last year, you can expect them this year. But in terms of fortifying your fences or being prepared to trap the animal, or just before the harvest, raccoons don't like either the smell or texture of moth flakes, naphthalene flakes.
Oh, okay.
And a sprinkling of those in the corn, I assume the corn patch is kind of a small backyard garden thing.
Uh-huh.
The moth flakes might help a little bit.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
Thanks very much for calling. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking the World of Wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist Larry Mueller here. Thanks for listening in. Give us a call if you have a question like Marilyn has in Wausau. Marilyn, hi.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thanks for taking my call. Just a quick comment before I get to my question. I think I know what happened to everybody's little finches and small birds during the coldest weather. They were in our backyard.
Ah, okay.
They're gone now, but they were here when it was cold.
Well, thanks for sending them back.
No problem. I wish they were here, though. Question is on moles. I walk regularly in the Rib Mountain State Park and the trails.
Mm-hmm.
And twice a year, usually June, and this most recent time it was in December, just before the snow fell, I will discover, I want to say, three or four moles within a half to a mile radius that are above ground, dead, no apparent markings on them. It just seems odd that, you know, they all show up within a 24-hour period because they weren't there one day, and the next day I walk the same trail, and there they are. And then they sit. Nobody seems to want to eat them.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering, is there a phenomena that causes them to come above ground and then they die, or do they die and they come above ground to die, or do they die in their holes and somebody moves them out? I'm curious.
Well, so am I, because that's the first time I've ever... It is very unusual to see a mole above ground, dead or alive.
Well, we've got one in the backyard that emerges every now and then, but he's definitely very much alive, and he goes back into his hole.
Yeah. Occasionally, I mean, they'll come up where they're digging, and they encounter a gravel walkway or the driveway or something, and they'll pop out of the ground and cross the obstacle or come up and look around and head back in. But to find the dead ones, well, let's take the question. There were a whole series of questions there. Let's take them piecemeal. Oh, that's quite all right. You know, usually in the spring, right now the moles are still active. They don't hibernate. They're active. They're just down deep below the frost line. So there's kind of a pulse of activity in the spring when they're kind of returning to the surface after the frost is out of the ground. And again in the fall, usually there's a little more precipitation in the spring and fall. The soil moisture is better, and the moles are closer to the surface. So it's not uncommon to see kind of a pulse in activity in terms of seeing the mounds and seeing the raised ridges where they're feeding at those times of year, just before things freeze up and they're driven deep. To find them above ground like that is, as I say, a bit unusual, and I can't explain that to you. The fact that they lie there for a while, I think, is related to the fact that shrews and moles both belong to the same biological order of mammals. And there's got to be something about those critters, including the shrews, that is distasteful or objectionable or something, because the main source of shrew specimens are shrews that are captured by the family cat and then brought into the kitchen or left on the doorstep, just kind of spit out, and the cats don't show a great deal of interest in them, and they're frequently not consumed. We tried a couple of experiments over lunch one day years ago in the lab and weren't able to confirm that. But nevertheless, there seems to be something about the shrews, and it may extend to the moles, that they're just not particularly palatable. So that may explain why they persist once they're out there, because most other things would be picked up by scavengers pretty quickly. But how and why they got above ground and what did them in, there are not that many predators for moles. So unless they were brought up by that activity again and then maybe near the surface and either caught by freezing weather or something else that did in a number of them. And when you say you see a number of them, then it suggests that it wasn't just an accident that befell one mole. It was perhaps something to do with a quick weather change or something else that caught them near the surface and ultimately killed them.
It did strike me as odd, and this is over a period of several years. I've noticed it like about twice a year. One time will be in the summer weather, and one time, this most recent time, was mid-December before we got heavy snowfalls, which was December 23rd is when we got our snow, and I'd say it was a week or so before that. And there were three of them in three different locations along the trails. You know, one was before you got to the summit of Rib Mountain State Park, and the other was up at the very top. So it's not like they would have been in the same runway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I'm just, that was why I thought, well, maybe there's some phenomena that brings them to the surface for a particular reason at those times of year.
Not that I know of, but I would speculate, since you're talking about the Wausau area, that's kind of getting to the northern fringe of the range of these animals. They tend to like deep, loamy soils that hold their burrow structure well, And as you start to get further and further toward northeastern Wisconsin, the soils get thinner. And if you've got, especially on Rib Mountain, where you've probably got thin soil and a rocky underlayment.
There can also be quite a bit of clay.
Yeah, this could be a case where the moles just, again, on the edge of their range are getting to the point where they either are blocked from going deep enough to escape the cold, either by a clay layer or a rock layer, and they just simply are not making it in that particular environment.
I
don't know.
Thanks, Marilyn.
Right, well, thank you.
Yeah. Stuart in DeForest, your turn now. Hi, Stuart.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Good.
That's good. Yeah, a couple weeks ago I had 4 male cardinals and 6 females in one tree. And I think it's the feed I have, actually, because they seem to really enjoy coming to my tree and eating, cleaning my feeder out.
Mm-hmm.
And also, the hawks like it, too, because 2 Sundays ago, I swear it was a goshawk was in the same tree. And I don't know if it was hard to tell. I couldn't get a picture, but looking by my National Geographic bird, Midwest bird guiding book or whatever, it had the red eyes, and it didn't have any brown markings.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of looked like a goshawk, but the next morning there was another hawk in a tree, a different one. It had some brown markings, and it had the same red eyes.
Well, the markings vary greatly from male to female and young to old, but by far the more likely bird to be watching over your feeders in this area at this time of year is a Cooper's hawk as opposed to a goshawk. And if you look in your bird books, you'll see the goshawk, the Cooper's hawk, and the sharp-shinned hawk form a nice series from small on the sharp-shinned to medium-sized on the Cooper's to fairly large on the goshawk, and otherwise they are very, very similar except for size. But Cooper's hawks have become quite common. They're a common backyard feeder.
We have
I don't want to say a pest. Some people perceive them as a pest, but, you know, they eat birds and other birds eat seeds, and that's the way it is. But I think if you check your field guide, it's far more likely that it was a Cooper's.
All right.
Okay, that's what I was trying to do is figure out, because they all look so similar in the immature ones and all that. And
right.
I was trying to go by size. Now, do they have any problem living with, because I know there's red-tailed hawks around there also. Is there competition between them, or?
No, the red tails are a lot different in terms of behavior and hunting and are probably more of a threat to rabbits and other mammal prey rather than the birds that the Coopers and goshawks tend to concentrate on.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, yep. Thanks a lot for calling. And Rick in Oconomowoc, your turn. Hi, Rick.
Good morning, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Enjoy the show very much. I'm glad
you
have it on. I have a question for Scott. I live a little north of Oconomowoc, about 5 miles. 11 houses, acre to acre and a half lots, a little bit of woodland, not much. The other day I was looking out my back window, and I noticed something which I thought at first was a ferret. It was probably 24 to 36 inches with tail, long tail obviously, either black or very dark brown, which crawled into my wood pile. And I was wondering, I don't believe ferrets are common in this area. I don't think they're native to the area. And I was wondering, could it be a ferret? If not, what might it be? And what do I do about it being in my wood pile?
Well, be careful when you're bringing in a load of firewood for the fire. Well, while it's possible that a ferret might be around because they're commonly traded in the pet trade and it could be out, they're typically lighter in coloration with dark extremities. It appears from the size you describe that a dark chocolate brown animal about that size and in the area. Are you anywhere near water?
Yeah, we have lakes around us.
Well, I think a much more likely explanation is a mink. It would be, depending on the sex of the mink, either about the same size as the ferret or even a little bigger. And it's an animal that might be frequenting the woodpile, not necessarily to live there. They usually stay closer to water, but maybe foraging around for mice or other prey within the woodpile. It's a little, what you describe is probably actually a little small for the next size up, which would be a fisher, and probably would be a little unusual in that particular area. But anyway, I think mink is the best bet. Size, shape, it would be very similar to a ferret. They're both members of the weasel family, and the color certainly fits.
Mm-hmm.
But
well,
whether
thank you so much.
Whether it's in there now or not is questionable.
Thanks, Rick. Marion in Windsor, your turn. Hi.
Hi. I want to talk about the raccoons and the corn. I find that if I lay down fencing, kind of coarse fencing or even chicken wire fencing along the edges of the rows of my corn, the raccoons don't like to walk on that. And I don't have my garden fenced in any way. And I just lay that down toward the harvest season. Or sometimes I have planted squash all around it. They mm-hmm. don't like to climb over those leaves either.
I've heard of the squash trick, planting vining squash like butternut or winter squash, which have very prickly stems and leaves, may discourage them. That's a possibility. The chicken wire trick obviously has some merit as well, but I would, if you're just putting it down prior to harvest, that's fine. But if you get carried away on that and the weeds start to get up through the chicken wire, it strikes me as being a nightmare trying to keep your garden weeded or clean with that chicken wire laying on ground zero. But if it works for you, then so much the better. But when it comes to raccoons, besides the squash, or the chicken wire, or the electric fencing, or the naphthalene, or I've heard people putting a little transistor radio out under a bucket and letting that play all night, discouraging them. There are a lot of things to try, but raccoons are pretty capable animals, so be prepared for the worst.
And thanks a lot for calling. Scott Craven, our guest, and he'll be with us right up till 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife with Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist. Thanks for listening in, and certainly if you have a question, give us a call. Scott has, you can't see this, but Scott is showing a wonderful poster, and tell us about that poster.
Well, every year the DNR's Endangered Bureau of Endangered Resources comes out with a poster promoting the donation program to the Endangered Resources Fund, the so-called tax checkoff, that you see a box for it on your state income tax returns every year. Most people are probably familiar with it, and it raises a lot of money for endangered and threatened species conservation. So this year, the poster, which came out a couple of weeks ago, is kind of a, well, how would you describe that? Kind of a grape-colored background. But the central photo is a really top-quality photograph of a marten, a pine marten, and a little flower in the background, and just a, it's just a really pretty poster.
It is.
The color scheme works well together, and these are available at the DNR service centers and offices. And not only do I urge you to consider a donation to the voluntary fund for wildlife conservation in the state when you file your taxes, but you might want to pick up these posters, because this one really would look nice framed
it
on
sure
your
would.
Wall. So I will present this one on behalf of all your faithful listeners, Larry, to you for your use. And I guess I urge other people to go out and try and get one. They're very pretty.
Thanks, Scott. And I can say that I have contributed virtually every year to that Endangered Resources Fund. That is, it has been on our tax form. And it's always kind of nice. It's another little deduction, sometimes bigger than some years bigger than others. But I always have supported it, and I hope everybody else does too.
Then you certainly deserve this poster. So
thanks, Scott. Well, let's go to Paul in Luck, Wisconsin next. Paul, hello to you.
Hello. Let's see. We're out kicking around in the woods. Came across a couple of dead trees that had a that were dug out about 4 feet high, maybe 6 feet high.
Really, a big hole.
Yeah.
Lots of wood chips lying around.
Right. Yeah, what does that?
That's a pileated woodpecker. It's,
oh.
It's the big woody woodpecker, crow-sized woodpecker with the red crest. Beautiful bird.
Right.
Very loud, distinctive call. A pair will range over a wide area, so they're not exactly abundant, but we have a couple of trees up at Kemp Station in Monaco where I'm also working, and once those pileated start working on them, they open up. They tend to open up kind of an oblong or rectangular hole rather than a round one.
Yeah, exactly.
And you can end up with two or three bushels of wood chips piled up under the tree, and eventually they'll go right through the tree and literally destroy it. So anyway, that's the work of the pileated woodpecker.
All right, they're busy.
They are.
They sure are.
All
thanks.
Right, thank you much.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. And let's go to Blue in Richland Center next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, I've got a couple questions regarding possums.
Okay.
We were having problems with possums invading our chicken coop. And I guess one question is there ways to deter them? I'm an organic certified farm, so I can't use, like, you know, chemical baits or anything like that. But if there's specific size live traps that work good, it seems like the one we have doesn't seem to really deter them in there. And then the other question is, let's see, how many babies do they have in their litters? And how many chickens do they tend to eat? I mean, it just seems like all of a sudden we noticed this decline in our chicken population. We realized what was going on because we heard some, you know, screeching in the chicken coop, so we went and checked it out. And I didn't realize, I guess, that possums were so fond of chickens. And
you saw the possum.
Yeah, and we did get rid of it. And then in fact we've got rid of about three more since then. we're not backed up to woods, but there's a wooded area across the lane, and they seem to come under like through a little pipe there.
Culvert, yeah.
Culvert, yep. And then they come up through there and come over to our chicken coop. Nice little perfect. So I was thinking about, one, could I put a screen on that culvert, or will that maybe block stuff in there that I shouldn't, that might deter them a little bit from just coming right through there?
Well, I think screening the culvert is not a good idea for a variety of reasons, because that can get clogged up and not only block other animals, but block its function. As far as, let's see, a whole series of questions. Don't worry about the chemical issue. There are no chemical baits registered for possum control anyway.
Okay.
So that isn't an issue. But they're very easy to catch in a live trap.
Okay.
Baited with a little fish-flavored cat food or table scraps. They're scavengers. They will prey on things like chickens on occasion, but they just as soon pick through the trash and find whatever they can, and they'll eat anything they can find.
Hmm.
But a good live trap, but when you said you have one, I would think you'd want one with a 6-inch by 6-inch door opening.
Okay.
The ones we use for research purposes are made up in Tomahawk, Wisconsin, the Tomahawk Live Trap Company.
Okay.
You can get them online. They make any size you could possibly want. They're very good, but there are many other good commercial brands too. The Have a Heart professional grade live traps are very good. And really it's what you can find, but the proper size and placement is more important than the brand name. And properly placed and baited, you should be able to intercept every possum that's headed for the chicken coop. But in terms of long-term solution and discouraging not just possums but raccoons and potentially other pests, a good barrier, perhaps not now obviously, but when the warm season rolls around, a good barrier of chicken wire or galvanized wire that simply prevents the possum, raccoon, or whatever else from getting into the pen will solve your problem over the long haul.
So can the possums dig underneath? We were trying to even figure out where it was getting in.
Well, they're good climbers too, so don't rule that out. But
okay.
They certainly aren't doing much digging this time of year. The ground is not prone to allow digging. So they may be climbing in, or there may be a gap or a cut or something that you haven't discovered yet.
Sure.
So check that out carefully. The litter size question is fairly easy. Possums are our only marsupial, like kangaroos, so the young are born very much undeveloped, and the essentially embryos make their way to the pouch, or marsupium, and attach to a teat or nipple there, and there are only 13 of them, so that's the maximum litter size. Although there are apparently records of up to 50 or 60 embryos produced, but typically the litter size is more likely 5, 6, 7, 8, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about all.
And I also noticed that scavengers and stuff don't tend to want to eat them. The ones we have killed and tossed over back in the woods, we still see them like a month later. We're like, what's up with that?
Yeah, possums are apparently, much like the moles and shrews we were talking about earlier, are not high on the scavenger list. And apparently they don't smell so good and just kind of a noxious animal. But not a big threat in other ways. They may hiss and snarl a little bit or play dead, but they're really a pretty innocuous animal unless they happen to be getting into your chickens.
Well, and if they do hurt the chicken, I mean, terrorized them pretty good. I mean, one of them was bleeding from the head and things like this. And, you know, luckily we intercepted when we did. But if they do make contact with them like that, with their mouth or claws, is there any diseases and stuff I should be concerned of watching on my chickens?
I doubt it. I think it's more of the mechanical injury problem, and but that's something you should take up with your vet or somebody who can advise you on those problems.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And, Scott, we've got the turkey tags. Before we go back to the phones, let's talk turkey here for a minute. We've got turkey permits issued and—
To some people.
Yeah, not to you or
not to
me.
You or me.
not to you or me.
Yes, as the turkey permits were mailed in January and are pretty much all out as of the first of this month, I think there were about 160,000 plus issued, which is a lot of permits going out. But despite the fact that neither you or I drew one, presumably because of our lousy choice of periods and times or something, there are still about 40,000 surplus permits that weren't requested or weren't awarded because of the combination of zone and time period. And much like last year, they will go on sale again, first come, first served, over the counter on March 23rd, I think starting at 10 o'clock in the morning. And unlike last year, this is actually on a weekday, so you can go to a DNR office or service center and buy them over the counter. Last year it was a Saturday, I think, and there were some online hassles. It took forever to get a permit. But if you missed out, like we did, I don't want to belabor the point that we missed out, but we did. Anyway, you've still got a chance to get a permit beginning on March 23rd.
And it just goes to show that they don't discriminate. If you're eliminated, you're eliminated. It doesn't make any difference who you are.
Right.
I think the DNR secretary was eliminated one year, so I...
Ooh.
Well, let's go to Roger in Dodgeville. Hi, Roger.
Hi. Another idea for keeping raccoon out, if the lady or anyone else's fence is tall enough, is recommended that you leave the top of the fence, like chicken wire, like 6 inches or more floppy.
Uh-huh.
And if the raccoon has to crawl up, it flops back to the outside and they aren't able to get over it.
Oh, that's pretty ingenious and insidious, but it sounds like a reasonable idea. I can see them going up there, and all of a sudden, whoa, they lean back. Now, I have to tell you that I have a lot of faith in raccoons.
Yes.
They're pretty dexterous, so I can imagine them figuring out how to defeat that over time, but it's a reasonable idea to get started.
Thanks. And then I have a question regarding live trapping. I've heard you various times on here recommend people trap and then take the animal somewhere else and relocate it. I've talked with the DNR about that. It's my understanding that that's not legal, that if an animal is trapped, it's supposed to either be released where it is or destroyed. It's not legally, you can't legally take another property. And what are the animals that we can trap if they're causing damage?
Well, the first case is first of all, this has come up a lot on the program over the years, and generally we try and discourage live trap and relocation because of that very problem. For one thing, most common animals that are live trapped, possums, raccoons, rabbits, and so forth, there are no other places where, hey, there are no rabbits here. A rabbit will live happily ever after in this spot. No such spots exist. And there are many places that are common repositories for trapped possums, coons, and so forth, like arboretums, parks, and so forth, that certainly don't want or need any more. However, if for example, you have a rural property of your own or a friend's property and you've caught a rabbit or possum or whatnot, and you have permission of the landowner or property manager to release it, then it is not illegal. The illegal aspect is simply dumping it somewhere where the landowner or manager is not aware of it. And there are some species like skunks, for example, where, again, I don't believe there's a legal requirement because of the potential disease transmission risk, the implication of skunks and rabies and other diseases, skunks should be euthanized rather than released as a matter of common sense, but not necessarily legality. But the crux of this issue, Roger, is that moving animals around the landscape is a problem for the animals that are relocated. It's a problem for the animals at the recipient site. And it's just not a – it's popular. I recognize its popularity because the animal, you can release it. It's out of sight, out of mind, and your assumption is that it's going to live happily ever after. But I'm not sure it works out that way very often in reality.
Yeah. Thanks, Roger, for calling. And let's see. Let's go to Gary next in Milwaukee. Hi, Gary.
Hi. How are you doing? I really enjoy your show. I've got a couple of issues. I live on the Milwaukee River, and I've got a about a five-acre piece of property with a pond on it. The pond's not connected to the river. But in any event, the last few months, we had a beaver on the property gnawing down some of my smaller sugar maples. Mm-hmm. Of course, it doesn't go after the buckthorn or the stuff I want down.
No, but, never, never.
or the box elder. But we never had it. We've been there for 10 years. Mm-hmm. There's never been a beaver in the area or anywhere that I know on the river.
Mm-hmm.
The other issue is I've seen a coyote, a lone coyote, periodically, but now, in fact, just last night, my dogs went berserk. I let them out, and they chased the coyotes out onto the pond. There were three of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I'm concerned. My dogs are retriever-type poodle mix. They're about 70, 80 pounds. They're running away from the dogs now. But when there's a pack of coyotes, are my dogs in danger? Should I keep them away? And also, is there something good about the coyotes, like maybe would they eat the beaver?
They're probably not going to eat the beaver. A wolf might, but I don't know about the coyotes. It's possible, though. The appearance of the beaver is not a huge surprise. I mean, they can cover lots of ground moving along water courses until they end up somewhere that they like and want to settle down, and that's apparently what's happened in the case of your beaver. Now, if you can tolerate some tree losses, they're an interesting curiosity and animal to observe. But if you can't or don't want to tolerate the damage, then you can likely either call the USDA Wildlife Services office in Sun Prairie and get some advice or help in having it removed, or your local DNR office, or a private pest control or wildlife control firm. I think there's a critter control franchise, for example, in the Milwaukee area, and they can also help you out. But I would not necessarily tolerate the clearing of your lot by that beaver if you want to get it removed.
Yeah, if only they'd go after the bad trees.
Well,
yeah.
They won't.
They won't.
And as far as the coyotes are concerned, you know, they're more of a fact of life. They're surprisingly abundant in the suburban urban area, and they're not going to be removed. A couple of individuals might, but the idea that an area can be rid of coyotes is just not in the cards. But if you've got some that are becoming particularly bold, or you know that there have been some pet problems in the area, then I'd be very careful with how you manage your pets in terms of letting them out or promoting the interaction between the coyotes and the pets. And again, that's something else that you might seek some help on from the same sources that I mentioned for the beaver.
Okay. Thanks, Gary.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Pat in East Troy. It's your turn now. Hi, Pat.
Hi. How are you, Larry?
Great. Thanks for calling.
I have an out-of-season question. I've been trying to get on and talk to Scott or whoever can answer my question for 6 months at least. Last summer, two different times, separated by about 3 months, I saw a water snake come toward my shoreline, which is surrounded with riprap boulders and things.
Mm-hmm.
And it swam directly toward me, had absolutely no fear. I was standing in shallow water until I saw him, and then I was not in the water any longer.
Really? Okay.
And it had its head out about 4 inches, and altogether I would say it was at least a yard long, maybe even longer.
Mm-hmm.
Not very big around, not more than 3/4 of an inch, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
I'm dying to know before next summer, is there any chance that that's poisonous, or will it do harm? Or they? I think it may have been two separate individuals.
I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, if you describe a shoreline with riprap on it that has all sorts of spaces and cavities, a perfect habitat for snakes. and any snake will swim well. It certainly could have been a water snake. We have the so-called northern banded water snake in Wisconsin. They're pretty widely distributed in the southern part of the state. And what you describe for habitat is exactly where I take my class out on the lower Wisconsin River in late spring on our field trip to capture snakes, and that's the snake we're after. They have a reputation for having a nasty disposition if you were to grab one or something like that, but having one swim by in the water or simply living in your riprap, I don't think that that's a problem in any way, shape, or manner, as long as you're prepared that you might see one, either basking in the sun on the rocks or swimming by. I don't think they pose any risk at all, and they may actually do you a little good in terms of what they might be eating or consuming that you wouldn't want in the riprap. So the short answer to your question is they're not poisonous. They might bite, again, if you grabbed one, but that's no more serious than being scratched by the family cat. So I wouldn't worry about it too much.
Well, that's very great relief. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot, Pat. And Bob in Rochester, Minnesota, we turn to you now. Hi, Bob.
Yeah, my question is, this last weekend I have an electric water feeder or a bird bath, and I had 12 robins in that this weekend. And I thought they went south for the winter. And do they travel in coveys or something like that? So there were so many? Or?
Well, they tend to flock up in the winter. And okay. Although the vast majority of robins do clear out for the winter, especially over along the Mississippi and some other river systems and some springs here in the Arboretum in Madison, there are some areas which notoriously hold flocks of robins for the winter. Mm-hmm. And they seem to be able to scrape up a living either occasionally visiting a feeder or picking up what fruits are persisting on different shrubs and whatnot, and they generally make it through. So it's not at all unusual, certainly not common because they're still right. The harbinger of spring, but it's not a surprise.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yep, thanks, Bob. Brian in Rockford, Illinois, your turn now.
How you doing today?
Great, thanks for calling.
Got a quick question for you. Early in the winter, before we had any snow, I live out in the country and a lot of open space, and in the ditches along the road, we were noticing a lot of holes that were dug that looked like a fresh groundhog hole, but it was at a time where I would think that all the groundhogs would be hibernating, and it wasn't just one hole. There'd sometimes be one that was kind of shallow, and then one next to it that would be a little bit deeper. And I was wondering if you have any idea what that might be.
So these are not water-filled ditches. These are high and dry, and the holes were of substantial diameter.
Yes.
Well, it's still possible, even in late fall, that although woodchucks or groundhogs are typically down by October, we had a pretty abnormally warm period leading right up into January, so it's still possible that it could have been woodchucks, but there are certainly other animals ranging from badgers rooting around there to try and find ground squirrels or something else to eat to foxes and so forth. But I still think woodchucks are a possibility.
It just seemed like there was an awful lot of them for woodchucks, and they'd be like just littered along the ditches in a few different areas.
And that's why it's possible that it was some other digging animal like a badger or a fox that was not necessarily interested in excavating a tunnel to live in or occupy or make a den, but rather simply digging up some food item that happened for whatever reason to be common there in the ditch.
Hmm. How common are badgers in northern Illinois?
Not common. Most people's only sightings of a badger, as in my case, I've been in Wisconsin for 30-some years now, have still yet to see a live one, but I've seen a number of road-killed badgers.
Yeah, I have too.
You know, it doesn't happen very often, but they're around, but they're pretty secretive, so it's still a possibility. I wouldn't say that they're not exactly an endangered species, but you're going to go a long time like I did not seeing one.
Thanks, Brian. Thanks a lot for calling. Well, with Brian's call from Illinois, we've had calls today from
Michigan, Minnesota, Illinois, and Wisconsin. I think
Iowa too.
And Iowa too. That's the slam. We should go celebrate.
We should celebrate. Thanks a lot, Scott, for being. You'll be back the first Wednesday of next month, and
yes.
We'll do this all over again. Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist, will be back on the first Wednesday of next month. And tomorrow, note that John Merrill, a professor emeritus in the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison, has some advice on home renovation and repair issues, and I had an energy audit done in my home, and we'll talk about that as well. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.